Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
And this is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And we have a guest tonight. I'm here, though, with Tom Bombasuto. How are you, Thomas?
I'm doing great, Drew. It's a beautiful day. The snow has melted from last night.
Yeah. It's freezing out there, Tom. You know, it's springtime. It's not supposed to be freezing cold in springtime.
I know. You got to wait to plant. You got to wait till Mother's Day.
Now you plant your cold plants right now. I've got my broccoli and my celery, my garlic and so forth, you know, my spinach. Hopefully that 25-degree weather didn't zap it last night, but I don't think it did. I think they survived it. But I'll find out for sure when I get home tonight.
That's right.
Anyway, we're here and we have a guest tonight, and our guest is John Wasik of who wrote the book Cain's Way to Wealth. Cain's Way to Wealth. Now, a lot of people would think Cain's Way to Wealth, come on, that's all about stealing from other people, taking their money, paying taxes, giving it to the government. That's all Cain's is all about. But I think that there's more to the story of John Maynard Keynes than what a lot of people realize. And we're going to talk to John about this. He's an award-winning columnist, blogger, editor, speaker, and author of 14 books. He's covered investor protection issues for more than 30 years and has won 18 awards for his writing. And you can find John at John. Let me think. Hey, John, are you there?
I sure am.
Ah, there you are. You got him on there, Noah, right? Yes. John, what's your blog page? Do you have one?
My general webpage is johnwasik.net, JohnWasik.net.
Okay. JohnWasik.net. So that's the way you can follow him. But tonight we're going to be talking about your book, Cain's Way to Wealth, Timeless Investment Lessons from the Great Economists. So, you know, when you hear the name John Maynard Keynes, most people think socialism, most people think government spending, take from the rich, give to the poor, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not really who John Maynard Keynes was really all about, was he?
Well, he was quite a capitalist. He loved trading, he loved speculating. And he was a professional money manager, and a lot of people don't know that story.
He was actually a hedge fund manager before people even knew what hedge funds were.
He was. He took a lot of risks. He had, like, some single strategy funds. And this was back in the 1920s and 30s, so he was way ahead of his time.
He used leverage a lot. He did a lot of shorting as well as going long stock, so he bet on both sides of the coin.
He sure did. He took quite a bit of risks, and you know, as you said, he was highly leveraged at one point, and then he played the market long.
But you know, he actually started out as a speculator himself. In other words, he would just bet on the direction of a stock or a currency or a commodity or something, but it ultimately hurt him, and he became somebody that disliked speculators ultimately.
Well, he was a kind of guy who liked gambling quite a bit. So when he got into this, he was betting on currencies right after World War I, and he was betting, you know, that they all were going to go in one direction. Well, 1920 comes along, and he was managing money for a bunch of friends. And he got wiped out because he guessed wrong on the direction of the currencies he was betting on.
Well, he was right, ultimately. He was just wrong in the, you know, thinking that it would just be a straight curve on the direction he was betting.
Yeah, ultimately, yeah, he was right. But he, like a lot of market timers, was in the wrong trade at the wrong time, which hits everybody sometimes.
Yep. So, you know, he ultimately gets wiped out, and he then learns, he basically despises speculating sort of after that. He became much more conservative, I guess.
Well, actually, it took him a lot longer to learn that lesson. Throughout the 20s, he was really heavily into commodities, and I looked at his trades, and he was into everything. I mean, it just kind of floored me as to how many different things he was speculating, and he was going long on tin, rubber, petroleum, just about anything you could take a position in. He had some contracts in wheat in the Chicago Board of Trade. You know, he was betting long on the European economy recovering, and that worked pretty well until about 1929.
Yeah, he gets wiped out in 29 again. He didn't get wiped out totally like he did in 1920, but he lost, what, 80% of his net worth?
Yeah, he was really creamed. And the thing was, at this time, he was managing his own money, his friend's money, some money for Cambridge University, and two insurance companies. So he wasn't just dabbling in his own account. He was managing some serious cash at that point.
Huh. And, you know, let's get the record straight, though. He was a pretty smart guy. I mean, he wrote this the book, The Economic Consequences of Peace, in 1919, and pretty much, I guess you could say, he literally prophesied everything that was going to happen over the next 20 years.
Well, this was an amazing work of economic history. He'd been sitting in on the Versailles talks after World War One, and as you know, there were a whole spate of reparations imposed on Germany. And Keynes kind of did the numbers, and he quit the conference. He was part of the British Treasury at that point and said, I don't have anything to do with this. You guys are going the wrong way on this. And he did the math and found out that, you know, there's no way that Germany could have repaid all of the penalties that the victors had lodged against them. And he said, look, this is going to really cause some economic catastrophe in Germany. And sure enough, he was right.
Yeah, and he basically said it was going to lead to fascism, and ultimately we'll be in another war before it's all over.
Yeah, I mean, his whole thing was, you know, how do you create economic stability long term? I mean, that was his great contribution to humanity, which led to Bretton Woods and some other things. But he, you know, had seen the devastation caused by World War One, the economic disparity between the two countries. And he said, look, you don't want to do this again. There's a way out of this. And sure enough, they didn't listen to him.
But he literally dies before World War II's final implementation of what did they call it after World War II, where they actually did the opposite of World War I. They actually implemented Maynard Keynes's theories and started to help Germany and help Japan, and he died before any of that really got into force.
Well, he had started the famous Bretton Woods talks with the U.S. Treasury Secretary, and it was this great infrastructure for stabilizing economies, and it created the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and some currency stability mechanisms. I mean, it was a very sophisticated model. The currency stuff got thrown out in the 70s, and currency started to float at that time. But the other mechanisms were designed to kind of pull up the weaker countries so there wasn't all this money concentrated in Central Europe and places where it had been causing a lot of trouble.
Right. But didn't he die in 1946?
He did, and he died in the middle of the whole creation of Bretton Woods, and he didn't live to see it kind of implemented.
And he actually proved that he was right, that, you know, I mean, look at Germany and Japan today. His theories were right, and what they did in World War One was wrong, and it probably was a major influence by why we had the war again in 1940. Anyway, John, you're going to have to hold on with me because we're going to have to take a time out with traffic. Are we taking traffic, Noah? You don't have anything here saying it, but I'm going to say Maggie Hunter is going to tell us what's happening with traffic, and we'll take it away, Maggie.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And this is Money, Riches, and Wealth. It's Drew Tignanelli here with Mr. Lived Well Bombasuto. Mon Basuto, you have a question for Mr. Wasik about Keynes.
That's right. Yeah, so, John, you know, looking to today, if you take Keynes' theories, looking at things like the Euro crisis and how that was handled, or some of the things going on with Russia and Ukraine, can you apply any of his theories to those situations and kind of project forward kind of the repercussions or the positive or negative impacts to how we've handled those situations?
Well, you know, Keynes had really a really great focus on macroeconomics, and a lot of people forget that his context was the 1930s and the Great Depression. So he had never seen hyperinflation. He'd never seen a unified Europe. You know, there was a lot of things that were just not even in his experience because he died in 46.
Right.
So to kind of extrapolate, you know, a lot of his theories, which were theories, is difficult. And I always get into this discussion with people. It's like, you know, he doesn't really have a theory about how countries can come together and, you know, do central banking and maintain stability, you know, in this kind of environment. I mean, it's an entirely different economy. And what's happening in Russia is something that goes back hundreds of years. I'm not quite sure what he would say.
But we would have had the opportunity with the pigs, as they were known for a while there, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, Spain, to let them fall and fail, yet they were supported. Doesn't that play into kind of some of the way he looked at things?
Well, it does. I mean, I think that he would have sought some sort of stimulus to revive those economies. He was into a concept called aggregate demand, which said that in unless you have people spending money and working, you really can't revive an economy. And for that, he's pretty much still correct, but you know, the question always was, you know, when you turn off the spigot, when you get government out of the picture. And, you know, he didn't live long enough to really answer that question. So in a lot of ways, it's really unfair to kind of project his theories onto an environment that he never really lived in.
See, now, one of the interesting things about Keynes, John, is between 1919 and 1930 or 32, he was, like, almost infallible. He was, like, predicting things and saying, what do you do, et cetera, et cetera. But along come the Great Depression, and even 8, 9, 10 years down the road, he himself was very disappointed in his own concepts of how to bring us out of that, wasn't he?
Well, he had advised Roosevelt when he came over to talk to Roosevelt during the New Deal days, the early days. Roosevelt treated him very badly, but most people who knew anything about economics had embraced what Keynes had to say. Keynes really saw this as a metaphor. He saw it, you know, as a like a starter on a car. It's like you got to get the engine going, however means, however way you can. And, you know, a lot of people were desperate for solutions, and not everything worked, and a lot of things did not work. But ultimately, the stimulus of World War II and ramping up the war machine really brought us out of the Depression. So,
right.
You know, in a way, he was right, but he was not right in the way that he thought he would.
So we want to get into now, you know, talking about what your book's all about, which is the investment philosophies of Keynes and how to apply them. And, Tom, you had one of the big ones that we saw in there.
Yeah, so you talk a little bit about risk and return and the importance of focusing on knowing the risks that you're doing and taking on even over the potential returns and prioritizing that. So you can speak to that a little bit?
Oh, sure. You know, he was surprisingly, you know, he was a contrarian. He was buying stocks when people said they'd never buy stocks again, you know, shades of like 2009. I mean, he was buying low and holding, a basic Warren Buffett sort of value strategy. And he evolved this way of thinking independently. So he knew what he was doing, and he knew he was going to get better valuations on the stocks he was buying, and what he was buying were very conservative companies. They were companies that were paying dividends, they had good cash flow, They were in pretty solid businesses. As Warren Buffett would say, they had really good moats, so there were high barriers of entry. So he liked railroads. He liked, you know, companies that did shipping or, you know, any kind of commodity. And he held on to them. He said, look, if things are going to look better, I want to hold these companies.
Now, you know, in 1936, 37, and 38, we had a very similar stock market and economic downturn as we did to 2007, 2008, and 2009. Matter of fact, if you put the charts on top of each other, it's almost eerie how exact they come on top of each other. And in 1936, 37, 38, Keynes took a shellacking. And when he did, one of the big insurance companies that he invested for, what was it called, National Mutual Life or something? Anyway, they really called him on the carpet. They asked him to come and tell us why you've maintained this philosophy of buy and hold.
Well, this was some of the most famous writing in all of investment history, where Keynes defended his sort of buy and hold position. He said, you know, the time to get out of the market is not when people are panicking. The time is to buy better valuations of companies that he likes. And that's, you know, that's what Warren Buffett's been doing forever. So he influenced people like Buffett and Graham and every one of the value school people. And it was just a classic approach. It's like, you know, if you want to jump out of the market, you're going to miss some of the best values. Unfortunately, this is what most people do not do. They say, oh, geez, look at the market. I'm never going to invest in this kind of market. And they wait till it goes up. They invest at the high point.
Right.
So it's counterintuitive.
Now, the thing that he wrote then was called General Theory, right? And it wasn't, I think it was just like a white paper or something, right? Or was it a book?
It was a classic text on macroeconomic theory. Now, if you pick it up, it's a difficult book to read. Most economic students have read it, or maybe they don't teach it anymore. But it's very dense, and it gets into a lot of different theories. But there's one chapter in it that's just pure gold, because it's the entire, you know, description of what he saw the markets doing. So we get the phrase "animal spirits" from that book. We get, you know, the market being a beauty contest, all the most famous phrases in all of, you know, Keynesian investment literature are in that book in one chapter. So if you don't read any of the other book, you can read I think it's chapter 12, and he describes markets just beautifully.
And those are some of the terms that some of the greatest investors of all time have used about the market, like Ben Graham used those terms. The market's like a beauty contest. Warren Buffett has said that many times. You know, the market gets like animal spirits. You know, these are terms that were picked up from Keynes and used over by many great investors.
Yep.
Absolutely, and it's passed into our everyday language. So when anybody says animal spirits, what they're really talking about is the sort of mass irrationality of the market, that it's herd behavior. You really can't predict it. There's no formula that's going to tell you when the next bust is going to be. So either you're in the market and you understand the risk, or, you know, you don't try to time it, because if you're following the crowd, you're going to be wrong.
Yeah. John, you're going to have to hold on with me, because we're going to have to find out what's going on with traffic again, and then we're going to come right back and we're going to go into some of the more significant philosophies that Keynes talked about, how to invest and so forth, and we'll be right back right now. Take it away, Maggie.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here, we're talking with John Wasik about Keynes' way to wealth. A lot of people think Keynes is the socialist, the socialism, take everything away, don't, you know, stop the investors, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But none of that's true. He was an active investor, Tom, and he was a speculator in a lot of ways. So you know, I think great investors need to study books like this. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, well, it's like so many things nowadays, because with the technology and information, everybody's just paying attention to today. And they think that the things that were written in the past don't matter today.
Or mistakes that somebody might have made 60, 70 years ago don't matter, but they do.
Right, yeah. I mean, and you talked about, you know, history repeats itself. Well, maybe not exactly, but it kind of rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we learn from the past and their experiences? And we've seen with a lot of these great investors that they have had times where they have struggled. And through those struggles and those experiences, you know, we talked about Keynes losing money, basically getting wiped out twice. We've talked about Buffett in the past, you know, losing, and he's like, I never want to lose that again. So while it wasn't big dollars for him, it was 100%, you know, if you will, or a large percentage of his portfolio of what he had at the time.
So, John, did you find that you became a better investor when you started to really delve into Keynes and his investing philosophies?
Well, you know, I had done a lot of things that he probably did when he was younger. I had speculated in some commodities, never got into currencies, but, you know, I was in and out of the market, and I never made any money. And, you know, I kind of went through this a long time ago, so it really validated my current strategy, which is to stay in the market, understand risk, have an investment policy statement, and just stay the course. I mean, here's the deal. You're probably familiar with the Dalbar study. It comes out every year about this time.
Right.
And he looks at the comparison between, you know, the actual returns of people in stock funds versus what the index does. And they're way behind. I mean, they're not even close. And the reason is that people kind of dart in and out at the wrong times. They don't get market returns. And they just don't stay the course. They, you know, they don't have any sort of you know, discipline that keeps them in the market, so they miss some of the best gains. I mean, a lot of people don't know some of the best gains in recent years started in 2009 when everybody was saying the world was going to hell in a handbasket, and have continued pretty much to this day. And you go back in history, and it's like some of the biggest gains in the stock market were in the mid-1930s. Now, you know, there was a series of recessions that were really characterizing the Great Depression, and most people don't realize it was not one long slide down. There were a couple of really good recoveries. And in fact, one of the best rebounds was in the 30s with small cap stocks. And had you been invested, you probably would have been great. But in order to get these returns, and you see like a 10% annual average return for big stocks since 25. Well, to get that return, you got to stay in the market. You have to know what kind of risk you're going to take. You have to be okay with the volatility, and you stay the course. But most people do not do that.
Now, he was actually promoted that, you know, even back then, that you shouldn't be sitting around worrying on a day-to-day basis what the news reports were telling you. In other words, you know, you shouldn't be watching CNBC every day for 24 hours of the day.
Well, that's true, and he really made a point of saying, look, this short-term stuff, you can't predict it, it's going to distract you, and we would say today it's just pure noise. So why listen to it? If you need to be in stocks for growth, you need to beat inflation, you have to be in stocks. There's no other way of doing it. I mean, you know, he was in commodities, and he got clobbered at the wrong time, but stocks that he held on to, you know, even going into World War II, did very well for him. He was one of the richest economists ever when he died.
Right. And, you know, Ray Dalio has created the concept of risk parity, where, you know, it's an offset of stocks, bonds, and commodities owned in certain ratios and leveraged to some degree on the commodity and bond side. It will give you what he calls an all-weather portfolio. And Keynes actually was talking about something very similar 70 years ago that no one really ever picked up on.
He was. And, you know, keep in mind, he predates modern portfolio theory, behavioral economics, the value investing school, Graham and Dodd, all those guys were real pioneers. And he just said, look, the basic thing that you need to keep in mind is that if you buy companies that have an intrinsic value, and he called it enterprise value, you know, they're probably going to be okay because they're generating cash and they're paying you dividends. I actually went into his portfolio, went over to England, to Cambridge University Archives, and looked at what he owned because nobody really knew. It was never in his biographies. And, the conventional wisdom was that he was a socialist, which wasn't true. So I looked in the portfolios and found out that he was holding some stocks that were paying like 6% dividends in the 1930s. It's just like, well, how good is that? That's fantastic.
Yeah. He was definitely somebody who always focused on buying dividend-paying companies. And like you say, they had to be big, like we've got here, Provincial Insurance, Zinc Corp, and Enfield Trolley. I don't have no idea what those three companies were, but I assume they all paid dividends.
And they did. Basically, he wanted companies that had cash on the balance sheet and were willing to share a piece of the profits with you. That's what dividends are. The company's not profitable. If it's like some tech company and just issue an IPO, you're not going to see any dividends. Where's the cash?
Right.
And it's all promise.
He didn't tend to like bonds, ultimately, as time went on. He became much more of a fan of owning good dividend-paying stocks, and bonds were just there in his portfolio to offset some of the downside risk of the stock market, and that when the market would drop, it would give him something that he could liquidate to put more money back into the market.
True, and in fact, when you look at the long-term return of bonds, they barely beat inflation. They're really bad news in a deflationary period. They're bad news in an inflationary period because they lose value. They're not paying anything today. So long-term, they're just kind of as a hedge against stocks and not much else.
Yeah, I think if Keynes were alive today, he'd hate bonds even more than he hated them back then, because back then they'd at least paid a real rate of return. Like you say, they just barely beat inflation. Today they don't even beat inflation.
Yeah, they're pretty sad. But most people think they have to own them, and it's not a bad idea to diversify against the risk of, say, stocks and commodities and real estate, things like that. But you have to put it in perspective. You can't load up on bonds. You can't have them dominate your portfolio. You'll never have any growth.
Yep. Now, you're going to have to hold on with us, John, because we have to take one last time out for Mark Thibodeau and weather. We're going to be right back to finish up understanding how Keynes made money in the markets. Keynes Way to Wealth, John Wasik, is with us, and we'll be right back. Money, Riches, and Wealth.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And as usual, Thomas, when we have a great guest and talking about a great topic, our time flies like there's no tomorrow.
That's right.
We're here talking with John about his book, Keynes Way to Wealth. Tell everybody how they can get in touch with you on your blog, John.
Well, I have a blog on Forbes.com called Bamboozlement. They can get in touch with me through there or email, johnwasik@gmail.com. Or my website is probably the best way, johnwasik.net.
Is bamboozlement a word?
Yes, it is. It's an old word, kind of means people who get swindled. It's not often used, but people who are bamboozled or deceived.
I've heard of bamboozle, but I never thought of it bamboozlement, and so forth. It makes sense that it would be. And so what is the purpose of the blog on Forbes, bamboozlement?
Well, I look at all sorts of financial deceptions. I look at overpriced 401ks. I look at scams. I look at things where people are getting swindled or just overpaying on certain financial products, so I try to steer them the right way.
Now, that's interesting. You don't mind I take a deviation here for a second, right, John? Because if that's what you're writing about, I have to ask you a question. Is one of the questions I get asked a lot, and I have to try to explain, and it's probably one of the toughest things that I can explain right now, is this whole concept of these annuities that supposedly pay this giant bonus up front and then guarantee you these incredible rates of return and never lose money in the stock market, et cetera. You ever had to do one on that?
Oh, sure. I look at those things all the time.
And are you? Do you believe they're the incredible, wonderful gift from these insurance companies, as I don't believe it is?
Well, here's the deal. Break it down. Ask what you are paying for the guarantees. Now, with every promise in an insurance product, they are getting the money from you somehow, either up front or through fees or through any number of commissions that they can charge you. So there is a cost to everything. If something's totally guaranteed, they're going to charge you for it. We're not going to get market returns. And you really have to look at these things carefully and vet them with a very qualified financial advisor who can take a look at them and read the fine print.
Yeah, well, you know, even the way they look at the indexes and they calculate the indexes as to what rate of return you're going to get are extremely deceptive, because most of those indexes don't even include the dividends, and the dividends are a large portion of how much rate of return has been made in these indexes over the last 50 or 100 years.
Sure, and Drew, you know, there's no free lunch in that business.
No. I always tell people when they say, well, how do they pay me a bonus of 6%? I say, well, you're going to pay the bonus over 10 years in fees.
Yeah, a lot of it is what they call return of capital. They're basically handing your money back to you. So you have to find out where's the money coming from and how are you getting paid and how much is it going to cost you.
You know, I think that's a great service. Bamboozlement on Forbes blog. John Wasik, W-A-S-I-K, and your blog is johnwasik.net, right?
Well, that's my homepage.
Your homepage. And I'm sure you can get from your homepage to the Forbes page, too, right?
Oh, yeah. You can just, you know, Google me, Forbes and John Wasik, and you'll pull up a bunch of stuff. I write for Reuters, New York Times, Morningstar.
Okay.
I do a lot of investment writing.
Thomas, we were going to ask him about inflation.
Yeah. You know, John, you know, we know Keynes despised inflation, and, you know, we're hearing a lot of central banks with these targeted inflation levels, you know, 2% targeted inflation. What would be the take on that, do you think?
Well, you know, one of the greatest fears of central banks is deflation, and it really was permeating the atmosphere in the 30s and, of course, right after 2008, when you have asset valuations going down that much. You know, then all boats sink. So that's what they're keeping an eye on. And having said that, everybody should keep an eye on inflation because it can ravage your fixed income part of your portfolio. So you really have to either look at vehicles that track rising interest rates, such as Treasury inflation-protected securities or adjustable rate securities, things like that, or stocks. Stocks are proven to beat inflation. Companies can raise their dividends, and you want companies that raise them on a regular basis. So, you know, you still need growth to beat inflation, and standard bonds will not do that for you.
And you talked about with stocks, you know, the idea of dollar cost averaging and getting into them that way. You want to talk about how that strategy works for folks?
Well, that's a great idea. I mean, if you're going to be in the market, you know, you want to stay in stocks, you want that growth. You know, whether you have a handful of stocks in your portfolio or you're investing through your 401k or, you know, other means, you know, invest on a regular basis so you're buying shares consistently month after month, so you're not constantly getting in at the highest point or the lowest point. You know, average out.
Is he there? I think we lost him.
Hello?
There you are.
There
you're
you
back
are.
Again.
Yeah, sorry. So you're not getting creamed when the market has huge dips or huge spikes. That's the point of dollar cost averaging.
Yeah, and Keynes used that a lot, didn't he?
He did. He was very instrumental in doing that, and he did it when he was you know, just starting out, and he kept on doing it throughout his career. It was a great idea.
So he, you know, you saw an example of a stock that he was buying at, like, I think it was 68, and it kept going down, 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 and, like, he kept buying 64, 63, 62, and all of a sudden it turned and it went up to about 70, and when it got to 70, his average cost was down around 64, and he sold and took his profit.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I mean, you're getting bargain prices if you stay in the market. If you stop buying, you're not going to get the best price.
Like Warren Buffett always says, John, he says, you know, when people hear over an aisle one big screen TVs are on sale and the price is reduced by 25%, they go running. But when they hear it in the stock market that the market's down 25%, they go run in the opposite direction.
Exactly, and that's when they should be buying.
We say buying when there's blood in the streets. Now, that wasn't a Keynes phrase, was it?
No.
That was Bernard Baruch.
That was Bernard Baruch, right. And anyway, so Keynes' Way to Wealth by John Wozniak and Timeless Investment Lessons from the Great Economist. And, you know, Keynes, I don't think Keynes understood the implications of telling government that they, you know, should increase spending. I think he meant that as a temporary thing. He didn't mean it that they were going to continue to do it. You know, that's one of the things that happens. If you get blamed for things that people pick up, but then perverted a little beyond what you ever expected.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he really wanted to get the economy moving in the 30s, and that was one of his solutions. I think had he lived longer, he would have evolved a more complete theory of markets and banking that took into account, you know, what the post-war environment was like. So, you know, there's temporary things and there's long-term things, and he never really had the long-term view.
Yeah. Well, John, we're out of time. Unbelievable as it is. And your fourth blog is Bamboozlement. And your own personal web is John Wasik, WASIK.net. And you can get and find out more about your work. And we really appreciate your time, John.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on.
All right. Your book, Keynes' Way to Wealth. And this is Money, Rich, and Wealth. Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.